Hey, wait. Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI.
Welcome back, everyone. We're diving deep again today, cracking open another incredible work of literature. And today, we're tackling a really significant one from India, Gobardhanaram Madhavaram Tripathi's Saraswati Chandra.
Indeed. And this is, well, it's more than just a novel. People call it a cultural epic, even a philosophical vichargranth, which, you know, translates roughly to a book of profound thoughts. It emerged from 19th century India, and really, it fundamentally shaped the Gujarati novel.
Wow, a book of profound thoughts. So its importance, it comes from exploring these big human questions, but through a very specific Indian cultural lens.
Exactly. And our mission today really is to unpack all of that, the huge story, the characters, the deep themes. We want to show why it's still seen as such a foundational text in modern Indian thought. And for you listening, getting a handle on this book, it's kind of a shortcut, you know, to understanding key parts of the Indian psyche and these timeless questions about love, duty, purpose.
That sounds fantastic. A cultural epic, you said. So what's the emotional core, the hook that pulls readers in? You mentioned that tension, personal desire versus like collective duty.
Yeah, that's right at the heart of it. It is a love story, a really intense one, but it gets caught right in that conflict. It's a story full of, well, dramatic renunciations, quite profound suffering, actually. And it forces you to ask, what does love really mean when it clashes with what society expects, with Dharma?
Okay, that sounds incredibly compelling. So let's start with the person behind it all, the author.
Gobardhanaram Madhavaram Tripathi lived 1855 to 1907, a colossal figure truly in Gujarati literature. And what's amazing is he was a successful lawyer, but he retired right at his peak to dedicate his life to writing and, importantly, to nation building.
He retired from law for literature. That's dedication.
It really was. He was absolutely a product of his time. The Indian Renaissance, the British Raj, a period of huge intellectual energy.
Yeah.
You know, his real genius, I think, was in how he brought things together. He was deep into ancient Indian philosophy, Vedanta, Dharma, you know, ultimate reality, moral law, duty. But he also really engaged with Western ideas, romanticism, utilitarianism, positivism. This blending defined his era, the Pandit Yug, the Age of Scholars.
The Age of Scholars. I like that. So they saw literature as a tool for upliftment.
Precisely. Moral, spiritual upliftment.
Yeah.
And Tripathi was central to that. He's called the father of the Gujarati novel, pioneered journalism, education, social critique. He basically established the psychological novel in Indian regional languages. So not just a storyteller, a profound thinker. He believed literature had to be a mirror, yeah, but also a path, a way to transform society.
That's quite a vision, putting literature right at the service of the nation. How did that translate into Saraswati Chandra itself? It's huge, right? It took 15 years.
Yes. That vision really shaped the book. It came out in four volumes over 15 years, 1887 to 1901. Just the timeline tells you it's his life's thought poured into it and the impact. Massive. It just said completely new standard for literary ambition, became this cultural epic. People initially treated it almost like a, well, a sacred text.
A sacred text. Wow. And what kind of story did he tell within that epic frame?
It's this incredible mix. There's social realism, digging into the society of the time. There's deep psychological exploration of the characters and layers of philosophical questions. It's a Bildungsroman, you know, tracing the hero's growth, but also a massive social novel. And interestingly, it first appeared serially in a magazine called Buddha Prakash. So you can almost see it evolving piece by piece.
Right. That makes sense given the time frame. So let's get into that story, the central premise. You mentioned Saraswati Chandra and Kumud. Set the scene for us, late 19th century India, princely states, colonial Bombay, the joint family system.
Okay, so Saraswati Chandra, he's brilliant, rich, educated in the West, a lawyer. But crucially, he's also deeply learned in Sanskrit, in Indian tradition. And Kumud Sundari Kumud, she's from Ratnanagari, very intelligent, graceful. Now, they haven't actually met, but they fall in love through letters.
Mm-hmm.
A really deep connection, intellectual, emotional, almost preordained, you feel.
Love through letters. Okay. But then something happens.
Yes. The inciting incident. It's dramatic. Saraswati Chandra feels deeply betrayed by his father. That was really his stepmother, Guman, manipulating things. He feels dishonored. And in this idealistic, maybe rash moment, he renounces everything, his wealth, his family. He just vanishes.
Vanishes, just like that. What about Kumud?
Exactly. She believes he's abandoned her, heartbroken. And then she's forced into an arranged marriage to Pramadathan, who's the complete opposite, dissolute, cruel, the son of the wise minister Budihan. A terrible match.
Oh, that's brutal. So that sets up the central question you mentioned.
Precisely. In a world with these rigid social rules, this strong sense of duty, dharma, what's the real purpose of love? Is it just about personal happiness?
Right.
Or can that love become something else, something bigger, maybe a force for society?
That's the conflict right there. Individual desire versus, well, social obligation, dharma.
Which isn't just duty, right? It's like righteousness, moral law, your place in the world.
Absolutely. It's deeply tied to social expectations, honor, tradition, the heart's truth versus society's structures. And that tension, I mean, it resonates everywhere, doesn't it? Even today, balancing what we want with what family or society expects. How do we navigate that?
It's a question that never gets old. Okay, so tell us about these characters and their journeys. Saraswati Chandra starts out so idealistic.
He does. Western educated, knows his Shakespeare and his Upanishads. But that first act, the renunciation, it comes from a noble place in his mind, maybe, but it's also profoundly immature. And it causes so much pain.
Right. Was Shripathi kind of critiquing that sort of impulsive idealism even while valuing renunciation later? I think he absolutely was exploring the complexities. Saraswati Chandra has to grow. His journey is fascinating. He starts wandering, calls himself Navin Chandra, experiences real life, hardship, even gets shipwrecked. And through all this, he learns that real renunciation, true sannyasa, isn't about running away from the world. It's about engaging with it, but selflessly, giving up selfish desires to serve.
Ah, so it's a different kind of renunciation.
Exactly. And his ultimate vision becomes Kayangram, this ideal community, a model village focused on social good. So he goes from this rigid idealist to a much more compassionate, practical visionary. He learns what service truly means.
That's quite an evolution. And then there's Kumud. You called her the moral center.
She really is.
Yeah.
Tragic, yes, but also the moral anchor of the novel. Immensely strong, graceful. Her love for Saraswati Chandra, that initial connection, it sustains her, even through the horror of her marriage to the abusive Pramadathan.
She endures so much.
She does, silently, maintaining her inner dignity, her spiritual faithfulness. Her journey is one of endurance, almost purification through suffering. She even tries to reform her husband, find strength in her spiritual beliefs. And her name, Kumud, means lotus, you know, purity growing in muddy water.
That's beautiful symbolism. But some might see her endurance as, well, passive, especially facing abuse. How did Tripathi handle that?
It's a fair point for a modern reader. I think Tripathi wasn't glossing over the suffering. Her strength, in the context of the time, was shown in her inner integrity, holding on to her dharma, her moral core, when everything outside is falling apart. It's an agency expressed through dignity, character, transforming suffering into wisdom. That was powerful then. And her later relationship with Saraswati Chandra, that platonic partnership, it's the ultimate expression of that spiritual bond.
Okay, that helps frame her resilience. And the other characters, Budhan, the wise minister.
Right, Budhan. His name means intellect is his wealth. He's pragmatic, wise, the minister in Ratnanagari. He kind of mentors Saraswati Chandra, helps ground his idealism in reality, represents wise leadership, trying to reform things within tradition. His political struggles were actually a big part of the story, too.
And the opposite, Pramadathan.
Pramadathan. Kumud's husband. He's the main antagonist, really. Arrogant, ignorant, cruel. He symbolizes the decay of the old aristocracy, highlights the social problems, the domestic abuse. A stark contrast that just makes Kumud's situation more painful to witness.
These characters really carry the weight of the novel's ideas, don't they?
They absolutely do. They embody the philosophical and social questions Tripathi is wrestling with.
So this huge story unfolds across four volumes. Can you walk us through the main arcs?
Okay, so volume one, Budhan's administration, sets it all up. The letter-based love, Saraswati Chandra's conflict with his father, the stepmother's scheming, then his big renunciation, vanishing, Kumud's devastation, the forced marriage to Pramadathan.
A dramatic start.
Very. Volume two. Gunasundari's family web focuses more on Kumud's suffering in that marriage, Pramadham's cruelty. Meanwhile, Saraswati Chandra, now Navin Chandra, gets shipwrecked near Suvarnapur, finds refuge in an ashram, and then the fateful reunion. Kumud visits a nearby temple. They see each other across a river. Instant recognition, just devastating for both.
Across a river, they can't even reach each other.
Exactly. Just intensifies Kumud's suffering, makes her husband even more suspicious, but she endures with dignity. Volume 3, The Statecraft of Ratnagari, shifts focus a bit. Saraswati Chandra goes to Ratnagari, becomes Budhan's trusted advisor, gets involved in state reform. The story broadens into political philosophy. And Kumud, a terrible turn. Humiliated, abandoned by Pramadathan, she attempts suicide.
Oh no.
But she's rescued by some holy women, taken to the Sundarsakiri ashram. Everyone thinks she's dead. Then Volume 4, The Consciousness of Saraswati. Everything converges at Sindhu Kiri Ashram. All the main characters, the different plot threads, Saraswata Chandra and Kumud are finally properly reunited. His family finds him too.
So the climax is at the ashram.
Yes. Lots of intense philosophical debate there about love, duty, marriage, purpose, and the resolution. It's profound. Pramodathan has died by this point, so society expects them to marry. But they choose something different. They decide to sublimate their personal love into this platonic partnership dedicated to selfless service. Their shared vision becomes creating Kaliangram, that model village for national upliftment. Personal love transforms into a universal mission.
Wow. That's not a typical ending. It really brings those themes to the forefront.
Absolutely. And what's fascinating is how these themes are explored. Take Dharma versus Prima, duty versus love. It's the central engine. The novel doesn't just pick a side. It suggests that Prima, deep selfless love, can actually become a higher form of Dharma when it's channeled into service.
Also, love isn't dismissed. It's elevated.
Exactly. Then there's tradition versus modernity. Saraswati Chandra lives this tension, right? Western education, Indian roots. Tripathi critiques the extremes, blindly copying the West, the suffocating parts of Indian tradition, like forced marriage, women's oppression. He calls for a thoughtful synthesis.
That Age of Scholars idea again, searching for that balance.
Yes. And the novel redefines renunciation for the greater good. True sannyasa, it argues, isn't escape. It's giving up selfish desires to work for others. Kaliangram is the embodiment of that, which also ties into the role of the educated elite in nation building. It's a call to action. Use your knowledge for reform.
Like a blueprint for the future.
Kind of, yeah.
And it's a powerful critique of social evils. Kumud's story is a damning indictment of women's lack of agency, domestic abuse. The corruption in Ratnagiri critiques bad governance. It explores individual versus society through Saraswata Chandra challenging norms. And the nature of love and marriage gets a nuanced look. It's not just love versus arranged, but about character, respect, how love can grow in traditional setups. Moral integrity is huge, Saraswata Chandra sticking to his truth even when it hurts. And suffering is shown as a catalyst for growth, for wisdom. Plus, women's agency, seen in Kumud and Gunasundari finding ways to act morally within constraints. It's just packed with layers. So these aren't just abstract ideas floated out there. They're lived, right, through the characters' choices, their pain.
Completely. Which raises an important question about how Tripathi does it, his craft.
Mm.
His narrative style is pretty distinctive. He uses this omniscient third-person narrator. But the narrator isn't just watching. They're commenting, teaching, guiding. Sometimes the story pauses for these almost essay-like bits on philosophy, politics, ethics. The narrator even talks directly to the reader. That's very Pandit Yug.
Because the narrator is a character in themselves, almost.
In a way, yes. A guiding voice. And the language, it's majestic, quite formal, lots of Sanskrit influence. Gives it grandeur, but yeah, it can be dense. And the four-volume structure just allows for that incredible depth, that slow, organic unfolding of character and theme.
And the symbolism must be powerful, too, to carry all that weight.
Oh, definitely. The sea comes up again and again, life's chaos, samsara. The cycle of suffering Saraswata Chandra has to navigate. The Sundargiri ashram represents this higher plane where conflicts get resolved through wisdom. And Kaliangram, that's the big one, the ultimate allegory for a better future for India built on service and justice.
Even the names, you mentioned Kumud the Lotus.
Right. Saraswata Chandra, Saraswati, goddess of knowledge, plus Chandra the moon. Knowledge and idealism. And letters, all the written communication, they often symbolize that gap between what's on the surface and the inner truth. Plus, he uses beautiful metaphors from nature, from classical texts. And there's deep irony, like Saraswata Chandra's noble act causing such suffering. The dialogue, too, often becomes philosophical debate, but it still feels like characters talking, revealing who they are.
It sounds like a real masterclass in weaving story and philosophy together. I imagine there are some memorable lines or ideas that stick with you.
Absolutely. These ideas often get distilled into really resonant statements.
Okay, let's unpack a few of those.
Well, one core idea, paraphrased, is something like, true love finds fulfillment not in possession or union, but in the spiritual elevation of both souls, even apart. That really explains Saraswata Chandra and Kumud's final choice, reframing love as this selfless uplifting force.
That perfectly captures their unique resolution.
And from Saraswata Chandra's own struggle. My head pulls me to duty and renunciation, but my heart pulls me to her. I must find a path honoring both.
Mm.
That's his whole journey, right? Finding that third way, Kaliangram, which integrates rather than chooses between head and heart.
You can feel the tension in that.
And then the overarching message, especially in the end, the welfare of the people is the highest law. A life for oneself is wasted. A life for the nation is truly lived. That's the patriotic core, connecting individual virtue to the collective good, to nation building.
A really powerful call to service.
Tripathi also offers this pragmatic take on marriage. There's no inherent relationship between love and marriage, but love can develop after marriage. It challenges pure romanticism, acknowledges the reality of arranged marriages, but sees potential for affection based on character.
A surprisingly nuanced view for the time.
Yeah, and his belief in inner worth. Purity of soul is the only true beauty, just emphasizing character over appearances. Saraswata Chandra's own code is reflected in. As long as a person lives by their principles, they remain happy. Though the novel really tests the limits and costs of that principle. The central dilemma is stated plainly. The conflict between duty and love is the eternal question of human life, identifying that universal core and finally distinguishing true selflessness. True sacrifice is done for another's happiness, not for your own glory. These ideas really form the philosophical heart of the novel.
It sounds like it leaves you with a lot to think about. Not easy answers, maybe, but big questions.
Definitely. Reading it has this profound effect. It's melancholic, awe-inspiring, tragic, but also strangely inspirational. It really pushes you intellectually and morally, makes you question your own definitions of love, success, duty, proposes this purpose rooted in service. It shifts how you might see things like arranged marriage, family duty, individual choice, and it really highlights suffering not just as pain, but as a potential path to wisdom. Ultimately, it makes you rethink what a successful life even means. Maybe it's more about integrity than getting what you desire. And those core questions, how to live meaningfully, balance our wants with our responsibilities, they just stick with you. They're still so relevant.
It's amazing how something so rooted in its time can still speak so directly to us. That universality is incredible. It makes you wonder, you know, about that Age of Scholars spirit. Have we lost some of that focus on literature as a tool for deep societal thought today? Maybe lessons there for us?
It's definitely food for thought. Saraswata Chandra really is a masterwork. Psychological realism, setting new paths from Indian literature, but tackling these huge universal themes.
And that deep dive into tradition versus modernity, conscience versus society, it just offers so much insight that feels incredibly relevant even now as we try to figure out human nature and how societies move forward. Mandatory closing line. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.